You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
Working Class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. And then there were 15. We are down to 15 Democratic candidates, actually mainstream candidates. And even a couple of those, you go, I don't know. I don't know if you want to consider them mainstream or not. Kamala Harris has dropped out of the 2020 race, citing, obviously, financial problems. She put in an email to supporters, "I've taken stock and looked at this from every angle, and over the last few days have come to one of the hardest decisions of my life. My campaign for president simply doesn't have the financial resources we need to continue. I'm not a billionaire," she writes. "I can't fund my own campaign, and as the campaign has gone on, it's become harder and harder to raise the money we need to compete," which is exactly what I tweeted out this morning when it was announced that she was stepping down, stepping aside. All of the people were going, "Oh, this is BS. Oh, this is terrible." And I said, "Did you send her money?" Because campaigns are about money. If you want to complain about the billionaires who self-fund campaigns, volunteer with a campaign, give a couple of bucks to a campaign. That is how it's done. And I mean, if you look at Sanders and Warren and some of the other campaigns, they've figured out how to do it. So I look at Kamala Harris, who, you know, very qualified, was a longtime prosecutor, a very popular senator from California. She just didn't connect with enough people who gave her money. Now, as it was pointed out to me, because I took that line as well, she doesn't have as many billionaires as others. Someone tweeted back to me and said, "Well, you might want to look at this." And Forbes magazine pointed out that she had more billionaire donors than anyone. Now, most of them came in the first quarter because she was on the rise and she was running something of a decent campaign. But the sad reality is, and this again comes back to, she just didn't connect. And the campaign was chaotic. You may remember back last month, they let their entire staff go in New Hampshire because they didn't have the money. They were going to go all in for Iowa. There's been, you know, tons of stories about chaos and mismanagement and all kind of stuff. She just didn't run a good campaign. Didn't have a good campaign. In fact, you know, there was a, if I remember right, the New York Times had you know, some stories about, you know, like 50 of her staffers that had, you know, come out and on the record talked about the dysfunction and talked about, you know, how the campaign wasn't doing thing, you know, basic things that needed to be done. So am I surprised she's out? No. Is she right when she says the country might not be ready for a black woman president? Probably, yeah. That's part of it. The bigger part is she just didn't raise the money. And sadly, our political system is based on who's raising the money, who can continue to compete on air. And is it right? No. I completely disagree with that on so many levels. I think we should have publicly funded elections that are matched by individual small donors so you have a more democratic process. And I think, look, Andrew Yang has the, the democracy dividend he was pitching, that everyone would get like $100 or $200 to donate to candidates. That seems like another idea. But this idea that we got to be, you know, raising money through super PACs and billionaires and big hedge funds and these huge corporations, I got a real problem with that. So to see Kamala Harris go, not happy about it. She was one of the seven people who actually made it onto would have made it had she stayed in, onto the debate stage for the December debate. Now that leaves us with 15 because Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, and former congressman Joe Sestak from Pennsylvania, the admiral, they both recently dropped out. No fanfare for them going, though. There wasn't much, "Oh, we're gonna miss them." They didn't connect either, and they didn't raise money either. So the, to be honest, the whole, you know, it's white privilege. I'm not buying it here, because Bullock, to be honest, was you know, much more qualified, I think, than she was. He actually ran a state. And if you want to just beat Trump, a guy who won in a red state, it's probably somebody you might want to have thought of, looked at. Sestak, no, I question why he even bothered. He got in late, and, well, he's now left early. But he did walk across New Hampshire, which, good for him. The guy does an awful lot of walking. Now you've simply got you've got Joe Biden, you've got Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Andrew Yang, Klobuchar, Booker, Bloomberg, Gabbard, Steyer, Castro, Bennett, Deval Patrick, who got in late, Marianna Williams still in it, Williamson still in it, and John Delaney, which I'm not sure why, other than he can self-fund. Of them, probably everyone from Klobuchar, keep her on the bubble, down should go. You know, Booker should go. Bloomberg shouldn't be there. Gabbard shouldn't be there. Steyer should go. Use his money to win back the Senate. Castro, sorry, Julian, you just didn't grab anybody's attention. Michael Bennett, I still have no idea why he's in it. Deval Patrick, had no idea why he jumped into it. Other than maybe looking for a cabinet job, don't know. Marianna Williamson, just kind of comic relief. Maybe keep her around for that. But Delaney, I have no idea why he even jumped into it. Let's get down to the real nuts and bolts of it. And you keep the top five or six. I would say the top four, but I know my Yang Gang folks want Andrew Yang. And look, I like to have him there as well because there's some reasonable ideas that come out of his head. So top six, go that route. And let's have some substantive debates about real issues and start to get ready for the ramp up to November. You know, start getting ready to get the message because it's going to be a lot harder the next couple of months with the impeachment that is coming. And as we find out today, a lot of stuff going on today in the House. In fact, like the House passed a resolution that disapproved Russia being added to the G7. You may remember back in 2014, I believe it was, they were expelled from the G8 for basically invading Crimea. And they've been out since. Now you've got Trump and some saying, oh, no, we should bring them back. G8, yay. No. In fact, the vote was kind of surprising, 339 to 71, which meant a lot of Republicans went with the Democrats to say, probably shouldn't be doing that. Very, very surprising. Also today, the Democrats released their impeachment report, which basically says what we already knew. Nothing of a real surprise here. Trump and his stonewalling of Congress is unprecedented. Yeah, we knew that. He did strong arm the Ukrainian president for his own political gain. Okay, I think that's been pretty well established. They did withhold vital military aid, and the meeting that really was the showpiece for the Ukrainian president to show that he had the backing of the U.S. and that maybe Russia would, you know, kind of slow down a bit. Just a thought. They also in this report point out that Trump's, you know, subordinates, the people in his cabinet, the people around him, the three amigos, his advisors, they all knew. They all knew. And it wasn't a secret. They all had direct knowledge. They knew. People like Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, people like Mike Pompeo, the secretary of state, Rick Perry, the secretary of energy, they all knew. And even all the way down, you know, to even Gordon, you know, hapless Gordon Sondland figured it out. So everybody knew. And then the Democrats have pointed out that Trump ordered and you know, orchestrated a campaign to cover it up. There was a cover up. And it was one of these things where, you know, they were telling people, don't testify, don't participate, don't give any information. And, oh, by the way, we got to go find that whistleblower. The big news that came out today, and, you know, every day there's like a new revelation of something that, you know, we've all already known, but now they have a document that backs it up. And I've been saying for the longest time, I have no idea why Devin Nunes, the Kremlin gremlin, was on the panel, was the chairman of the committee there over the last couple of weeks as the hearings were going on. You know, basically his only defense is all a hoax. You know, it made me think of, you know, my cousin Vinny. If you ever watch that movie, My Cousin Vinny, where Joe Pesci gets up and goes to defend his cousin. after the prosecution has laid out in quite eloquent style all of the crimes and all of the things that these kids supposedly did. And Joe Pesci gets up and says, it's all BS. Thank you, and sits down. That's basically the defense. It's all BS. It doesn't mean anything. That's been their defense. But what came out of today's bombshell is evidently there are call records that show that there was, in fact, communications between Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas, Giuliani's buddy, and Devin Nunes, the Kremlin gremlin, and the White House. There is now documents. And I was looking at the phone calls because there's now, you know, a list of the phone calls that were made. And, you know, the durations of these phone calls are like, you know, 35 seconds, 31 seconds. And it made me think, it's, you know, this is one of those moments where it's, you know, the call goes, and I'm not saying this is how it went, but when I see those times, the call goes something like this. Hey, Devin, Rudy, call me back. Here's the number. I'm at a payphone. Or, you know, I got a burner phone. You don't make 35-second calls unless you're directing someone somewhere else. And there were a bunch of those where there was, you know, a minute long, a minute and 27 seconds, where you've got these conversations between all of these actors. And it's, you know, all around that same time in April where they're all setting this stuff up. And you go, you know, Lev Parnas had like 8 cell phones. So, you know, he was even keeping the burner phones records. And, you know, when you have somebody who's keeping all the records to cover his behind for just in case, maybe you should worry. Just kind of throwing that out as a thought. But then again, it brings me back to a big question I now have for Devin Nunes, which is, why didn't he disclose this during the committee hearings? Why didn't he come forward and say that he had contact with these people? You know, there's lying, and there's lying by omission. And I found it interesting that today, and this is one of those things that you go, kind of an interesting bit of timing for Devin Nunes, because while this is dropping, that we now find out that Nunes, the Kremlin gremlin, is, you know, actively involved with Giuliani and Parnas and the White House. And we had known for a while that he was running back and forth during the Mueller probe to the White House, back and forth at midnight, making midnight runs. Today, when this drops, he decides today is the day to file a $435 million lawsuit for defamation and false stories on Ukraine against CNN. And when I saw this, I'm going, $435. Why don't you just go, I want a gazillion dollars. I want all the money that there ever has been or ever will be, and I will sue for it. Because guess what? You can sue for all of that. You're not getting anything. You are a sitting U.S. representative. You are a public figure. Sorry, not helping you. So why would you file this lawsuit? Well, you file the lawsuit because you want to change the story. You want to change people's attention and go, a gazillion dollar lawsuit. He's so confident he's going to sue for a gazillion dollars. That's one of those things where you're playing with somebody who bluffs when you're playing poker, and we're going all in. Chances are they don't have anything. They're just bluffing. This is what this is. So I think Devin's trying to keep himself out of jail. It will be interesting to see what comes out of the next group of hearings now that we know that the Kremlin gremlin is directly now with these phone records directly connected to all of this. We now know without question. Now, is he going to answer for them? Is this one of those moments where maybe he's going to have to testify? Let's depose him. Going to get very interesting over the next couple of weeks. I'm quite sure. I'd love to hear your thoughts, though. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, going to talk a little bit more about the impeachment hearings, the responses from both the Democrats and the Republicans, and a bit more with our good friend Brett Pansky. Perk, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives.
There's a voice to win on the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day a general strike erupted in Oakland, California. Workers, mostly women, had been on strike for a month at two downtown department stores. Teamsters honored their picket lines and refused to make deliveries. Infuriated owners of Hastings and Conn's demanded their merchandise and turned to the city for help. And on this day, police assembled early in the morning to clear the streets of picketers. They attacked strikers, forcing them off the street and setting up a perimeter of machine guns to escort scab delivery trucks through the line. One striker recalled, "I was black and blue for 6 months from their clubs." Outraged, truck drivers, bus drivers, and streetcar operators all stopped, got out of their vehicles, and joined the strikers, quickly filling downtown Oakland. By the end of the day, the city was completely shut down. 142 AFL unions called for a labor holiday in support of the strikers, and now 130,000 workers were on strike in solidarity. UAW member Stan Weir recalled that it was the bus drivers, many just returned from the war, who led the strike. The streets that night had a carnival-like atmosphere. War vets led a march to City Hall to demand the resignation of the mayor and city council for their attempts to break the strike. The general strike quickly forced the administration to stop the scab herding. But local labor leaders were divided over what some considered a near insurrection and called the strike off 54 hours later. The retail workers were left to fight on their own for another 5 months. But for a few days, workers got a taste of their own power. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm trying to figure out if Lindsey Graham is Dr. Jekyll or just covering his hide. Because, you know, this is one of those moments where he was interviewed this week. And he said, you know, it was the Russians. 1,000%. He's 1,000% confident. It was the Russians who hacked the DNC. It was Russian operatives. It was nobody else. He went on CNN. He said, "I've got no doubt it was the Russians who stole the DNC's emails. It wasn't Ukraine." And he was very clear. Wasn't Ukraine. He said Russia was behind the stolen DNC emails. Flat out. He said, you know, so as of the Ukraine, they had zero to do with the hacking of the DNC. And I'm curious because, you know, he's been floating these, all of these ideas, as have the Republicans, that maybe it wasn't the Russians. Maybe it was the Ukrainians. And that's why Trump was strong-arming Zelensky to really, it wasn't about Hunter Biden or his political opponent. He really cared about corruption. Yeah, I'm just thinking covering his hide. Just a thought. Also, he floated the idea of censure. You know, stopping the impeachment process for censure, which to me, very, very telling. And here to share some thoughts on where we are with the impeachment and all of the shenanigans going on around the Trump circus, I've asked our good friend Brett Pransky to come talk with us. Brett's a professor, also a incredible writer. Brett, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what do you think of this? This, you know, Lindsey Graham, you know, coming out 1,000%, it was Russia.
Yeah, that seems kind of an odd turn. I mean, he's really been kind of leading the charge, you know, in terms of, you know, kind of the lie train that the Republicans have been telling. He's been pretty reliable for a while now. So if he's backing off or taking a turn, you can probably expect several others to follow him.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those weird moments because, you know, with him throwing out the idea of censure, with him saying, you know, definitively it was the Russians, basically undermining the entire Republican defense of Trump. You're right. It threw up a lot of red flags for me.
Yeah, especially when you hear a word like censure. I mean, that is such a big deal. I think we've only, and you'll have to check my history on this, but I think we've only ever had one president in our history censured. So throwing out a word like that is a really big deal. And if you're throwing it out there, you're not doing it lightly and you're not doing it by accident. You're fishing for something.
Yeah, but you know, you look at what the Democrats laid out in their hearing report, with this impeachment report that's out. And they've laid out a very, very compelling case that, yes, Trump did strong arm the Ukrainians. Yes, the Ukrainians did know. And yes, everybody along the way knew what Trump was doing. And yes, they did try and cover it up. It just seems like, you know, so simple to get from point A to B that even the Republicans can see it.
Yeah, I mean, well, honestly, I think the Republicans have seen it from the start. And that's why most of the defenses they've been putting up have really had very little or, and often nothing to do with the facts of the case. You'll notice that no one is really defending the president's actions. They're demeaning the process. They're going after Democrats. They're saying that it should have never happened. But everything's about process and nothing is about the actual substance. And that's probably because, you know, they know he did it.
A good point. Now, you got Fox News and you got someone like Tucker Carlson who's defending Putin. I guess we're you got Fox News not just, you know, defending Trump, but also trying to reinvent Putin, saying for all his faults, Putin doesn't hate America as much as Chuck Todd does. You go, really? Is that where you're going?
Yeah, that is really strange. In fact, Fox News as a whole has been a really strange animal lately. Usually the network, pretty much from top to bottom, while the nighttime folks usually get a little more extreme than the daytime folks. Usually everybody's on message and everybody is rowing in the same direction. Now we have our morning show, which is playing for their audience of one. The people in the middle of the day are beginning to push back and actually say things that line up with some of the other networks. And then the nighttime folks come on, your Hannity's and your Tucker Carlson's and so on, and they just go full on crazy for the rest of the night. It's really been strange to watch. It's almost like there's three different networks in any given day.
Yeah, it really is. And the more we find out, like today, again, we find out that Devin Nunes, who was sitting as the chair, the minority chair during those hearings in the Intelligence Committee, we now find out that there were phone calls between him and Rudy Giuliani and Giuliani's recently indicted associate, Lev Parnas. And they're the kind of phone calls where you go like 30 seconds, 31 seconds long, where you go, hey, you know, give me a call back on my burner phone or on a payphone.
Yeah, that is turning out to be really strange. In fact, the first thing that came to mind was that that mob movie from a few years back with Leonardo DiCaprio and Jack Nicholson, and I can't forget who played the dirty cop, but he was essentially investigating himself. That's pretty much what Nunes was doing in those hearings. He was investigating himself, and he just didn't tell anybody. And that is really strange. I don't know how you don't recuse in a situation like that, but there's got to be some form of penalty for that. And I'm not sure what form it's going to take, but he's just not going to get away with it.
No, and he shouldn't. I mean, the first question I ask is, you know, why didn't he disclose this? I mean, Right. You knew those calls were out there. I mean, you're sitting there and, you know, basically his only defense, as you pointed out, was it's all a hoax. It's all bad. It's all BS. Nothing to see. Move along. While the Democrats are laying out in a very methodical pathway, build the building blocks to ousting this president.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the facts are what they are. But we need to take into account kind of how the two different sides argue as well. For example, on the left and, you know, folks that lean a little more progressive, we have a tendency to argue the difference between right and wrong. But our opponents on the right don't always engage this way. Some do, most don't. On the right, mostly what we get is an argument where the winner and loser is not determined by who's right and who's wrong, but by who's strong and who's weak.
Right.
So it really doesn't matter what position you take as long as you're the strong one. So if you're willing to tell that lie, you know, in a very big way, very loud, and, you know, slamming your fist on the table, you know, Jim Jordan style, then you're seen as strong and your people pick up on that. And that tends to play well on the right.
No, it's an excellent observation. And it's basically how Trump got to where he's at. You know, I mean, policy wise, he's terrible. He's about an inch, well, a half an inch deep on any issue. But yet people still see him as. Or his supporters still see him in that vein of that he's a strong leader, and he's not. I mean, he's turning into an international joke.
Yeah, well, I would say that he's not turning into. I'd say that process is complete. So, but you're absolutely right. I mean, this idea that he puts on this kind of tough guy, kind of bravado act, and it does work. You know, kind of in places. And I don't want to label anybody, but there are Trump voters out there for whom that is the primary draw, is the fact that regardless of what he says, no matter how crazy it might be, he's willing to say it from a position of strength, even when it isn't real, even if it's just pretend strength. he's willing to say that and say it loud and say it, you know, in what looks like a very powerful way. And there are people out there who will buy that.
Yeah, sadly, you're correct. But my concern is that, you know, you've got, you know, Bill Barr running around the world, not just here in the country, running around the world trying to prove the Trump theory of that it was really Ukraine, it wasn't Russia. And you've got these competing views that even now with Lindsey Graham's statement has even, I think, is going to split the Republicans. I fear that, again, this does nothing but aid Putin and Russia and their aims to undermine our election come 2020.
Yeah, I don't think there's any outcome that isn't good for Russia. You know, when it comes right down to it, the fact that we're fighting about this, and, you know, regardless of who wins in the end, the damage has been done. You know, we can minimize it. We can, you know, try to come together. But there's been a lot of damage done, and it was done exactly how it was planned to be done. And, you know, in terms of this being a kind of a foreign intelligence operation, it has worked beautifully.
No, you're right. The person I feel sorry for most in all of this is President Zelensky, because he was between a rock and a hard place. And we now find out from the Democrats' report that, you know, he knew all about it. He knew he had to play the role of, you know, whatever you want, Mr. President, you're wonderful, you're terrific, we'll do whatever you want. But please, we need the aid. We need at least the view that the U.S. backs us, so Russia just doesn't steamroller over us.
Yeah, and that is really unfortunate, because the president used the statements that he coerced, essentially, as proof of his own innocence. But anybody who's even paying a little bit of attention knows that we're not listening to someone who is freely saying what they actually think. It was, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, it was almost like the answer a hostage would give, you know. And it was really kind of sad to see, because we have this new president, you know, comes in on a reform message and really looks to be the real deal in terms of wanting to fight corruption and things like that. And the first thing he has to deal with is corruption, not within, but from without. And on top of that, it's from the most powerful nation on earth. I mean, how do you deal with that if you're in a position like his? It's impossible.
Yeah, we're going to help you fight corruption there. But first, we need you to be corrupt.
Precisely.
I mean, it's just a weird kind of thing. And I've had people, you know, basically, you know, say, well, you know, that was Donald Trump's main concern. And it got me thinking. I'm going, well, you know, does Trump have like a corruption sense? You know, is it like his spidey sense? Does one corrupt guy know another? I don't know. But, you know, this seems to me exactly what it is. Trump saw an opportunity to strong arm someone who was weaker into doing something that would help him politically. That simple. Case closed, period, end of discussion.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's really unfortunate that it's gone down that way. But it also tells us quite a bit about what's going to happen if we don't do what we have to do now. I mean, if we think that this is the last corrupt act that this president is going to engage in, I mean, if you follow the timeline, it's pretty much the Mueller report comes out. Barr does everything he can to squash it and make it appear, you know, as if the president has been exonerated. That becomes the narrative. The president starts to feel as if he's been exonerated, and he immediately engages in the next corrupt thing he's going to do. And so if he is acquitted in the Senate, what do you think is going to happen next? 2020 is going to be a madhouse. And, you know, we're basically going to invite in every foreign bad actor we can, because why not? There's no penalty for it.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And sadly so. And, you know, as you've pointed out, if he got away with it once and immediately went and pulled off another crime, as where I think most sane people, most of us would go, hey, I got away with that. I should probably lay low. Not this guy. We're doubling down. And if he gets away with this, he's going to triple down.
Yeah, most likely that'll be the case. I already think that the 2020 is going to be just, you know, just full of some of the worst kinds of disinformation, you know, imaginable. But if Trump comes out of this unscathed, then it's going to be, you know, it's going to be the worst election cycle in history.
Well, I do see him. I do see he's going to be impeached. I don't think there's any question that the House will impeach.
Right.
I just don't see the Senate having the courage. Unless there's another bomb to drop, there's more phone calls that this Parnas guy has, unless there's more that ties a number of other Republicans to this, I just don't see the Republicans in the Senate I just don't see them doing anything.
Yeah, or if they do, it'll happen 100% completely all at the same time. You know, no, it's not going to trickle in. There's not going to be one person who decides to see reason, and then the next person follows, and then the next person follows. Someone in leadership will come out, make the declaration that the GOP has changed their stripes, and then everyone will follow suit, or they won't.
Can they do that? I mean, though, at this point, is it possible at this point for the Republicans who have been so deep into Trump, is it possible for them to do this?
I think it is. I mean, when you think about, you know, Republicans and Republican voters, we know a couple things about them. One, they vote the party no matter what. And two, they vote no matter what. So even though there's a lot fewer of them in the country, they have a tendency to win elections whenever we don't show up. So I don't know that either one of those two things necessarily changes by, you know, in a dramatic way. You know, if the GOP decides to make a turn against Trump, I think if it happens, and I'm not sure what the filing dates are, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen as soon as these guys can no longer, as soon as they're no longer worried about competition, about getting someone on their right. As soon as those filing deadlines start to pass, then we'll know what they're really about.
Yeah, good point. Last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, obviously, through the holidays, we're going to get this impeachment, you know, process moving. What are you paying attention to? What are you keeping your eye on?
Well, I think this next these hearings that start in the morning are going to be interesting if they get some attention, because what we're going to be talking about, we're bringing in, you know, law professors and scholars and people who, you know, who know the Constitution backwards and forwards to talk about impeachment. You know, specifically, what is it? What is it not? What is it supposed to do? What is it not supposed to do? And so on. And I think that educating the public on what impeachment is, what it's for, and why it's so necessary, if that gets through, then we could see, you know, we could see some really interesting testimony. But I'm just not sure, you know, that a bunch of eggheads like myself, you know, testifying before Congress is going to be something that burns up our television screens, but it could be.
No,
you
know, it could
be. We'll have to see how well these folks perform.
Yeah. And that's the sad thing. It's a performance instead of, you know, this is, you know, a fundamental of our democracy where all of us should know what impeachment is and the process because we learned about it in high school civics. We're now going to get treated to a day worth of you know, probably very dry, very technical stuff from people who are not great performers.
Yeah, but the upside to it is, though, that when we talk about the folks who are going to be coming in and what they've dedicated their lives to, we have people who are tremendously invested, you know, in the subject at hand. You know, they care very deeply about what's going on and why this is happening and that the proper outcome comes out of it. So I don't think it's necessarily going to be just a bunch of stuffy old professors. It'll be a little bit of that. But I think we're going to see some people who, you know, I think some of that emotion is going to break through.
Well, we will see. Brett, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. I look forward to having you back real soon as this continues down the road.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Our good friend Brett Bransky. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1833. That was the day that the Oberlin Collegiate Institute was founded in North Central Ohio. Today, it's known as Oberlin College. The college was the project of two Presbyterian ministers, John J. Seifert and Philo Stewart. Their goal was to form a college based on Christian principles. In the early days, tuition was free and students were expected to give their labor to help sustain the school and community. The college motto, "Learning and Labor," harkens back to that time. From early on, the college was different than many other institutions of higher learning of its day. In 1835, Oberlin became the first predominantly white college to admit black male students. 2 years later, Oberlin broke new ground again,
letting in women and becoming the first co-ed college in the nation. By opening its doors to Black and women enrollees, Oberlin gave these students a chance to study and pursue careers that might otherwise have been closed to them. By the turn of the 20th century, one-third of all Black professionals in the United States had graduated from Oberlin. In 1862, Mary Jane Patterson became the first African-American woman to earn her bachelorette degree from Oberlin. She became a teacher and principal. Another Black graduate, John Mercer Langston, would become the first Black lawyer in Ohio and first Black congressman to represent Virginia in Washington, D.C. Oberlin College was also known for its stance supporting the abolition of slavery and later supporting civil rights. The school was a stop on the Underground Railroad, which helped enslaved people escape into freedom to Canada. And to this day, the Oberlin community is still on the cutting edge of opportunity and change. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, look, I'm looking forward fully to what is coming tomorrow as the hearings begin. And look, I'm hopeful that these four professors who are going to come and educate us on what impeachment is for, what the founders wanted. I'm hoping that this is going to be a moment where all of us pay attention and learn something, and you know, and maybe begin to swing the polls back in the direction of, you know, this guy did something wrong and he needs to be held accountable. And like I said, I find it interesting that Lindsey Graham has floated the idea of censure. That speaks volumes, that there's probably more discussion going on within the Republican ranks than we probably think. So we're gonna find out. The UN has put out a new report that has said the 2010s have been the hottest decade on record. They point out that the World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, on Tuesday warned that preliminary data suggests that from 10 to 19, almost certainly the hottest decade on record. They point out that the average temperatures over the past 5 years and 10 years are almost certainly the warmest 5- and 10-year period on record. So it's getting hotter. Oceans are now at their highest recorded temperatures. 2019 is set to be the second or thirdest warmest year since 1850. Seawater is 26% more acidic than at the start of the industrial era, which means I'm never going to see the Great Barrier Reef. By the time I get there, it will be completely bleached out. So no diving for me. They also point out that Arctic sea ice is approaching record lows this year. Also, the Arctic saw a record low ice several times this year. So we're yay. They also point out another report from Oxfam. They point out that climate change forces 20 million people from their homes fleeing each and every year. And you see all these refugee problems going on. War causes them. Climate change is going to cause it even worse. And it's mostly right now, it's just the poor areas, the really dirt poor areas. They're the people who are being most affected by this as water supplies dry up, as soil dries out, as it becomes much hotter. They're now looking to go somewhere else. And this is one of those things where the industrialized world, the wealthier countries, had better be ready for it. And I've been saying for a long time, you better start thinking about, all of Latin America making their way up this way as sea levels rise, as things get turned much worse. Wait for the refugee crisis that's coming if we do nothing on the climate change issue. But again, you still have a political party in this country that is dead set against any discussion on how we actually address what is a crisis. And there have been a number of people who have said, look, we've got to look at this as wartime footing. We've got to look at this in a way that we've never looked at anything, a new Manhattan Project. We need to really buckle down and and think about it. And I think the younger generation gets it. But this is stuff that comes from the policy level down. This comes from, you're only going to solve this by governments committing to doing things and by having policies that move in those directions and incentivizing it. You know, look, I'm a big supporter of incentives. I'm a big supporter of giving people the ability to put solar panels on their house with subsidies, using geothermal or using alternative energies in certain ways. And we were doing some of that during the Obama years. And what happened? Well, you had Republican opposition, because all you hear from a conservative today is Solyndra, Solyndra. And, you know, every business, every industry, everything like this is going to have some bumps in the road. But for me, the idea of getting off the fossil fuel and moving into a direction where we're no longer harming the planet seems like a smart move. And, you know, I've been listening to some of the candidates talk about regenerative farming and all kinds of other things. And it's just, you know, there are ideas and options out there. It's just a matter of, do we have the political will? Do we have the political wherewithal? And I don't know that we do as a country yet, because it hasn't really affected us, hasn't really affected our daily lives. We're not really seeing the devastation caused by climate change. I mean, occasionally we get a bad storm. I mean, we just had the bomb cyclone, and, you know, dumped a ton of snow and tons of rain and, you know, all kinds of chaos. You know, some 50 million people in this country affected by it. But it goes away, and we handle it, and we deal with it, and we dig out. And then you get some idiot go, see, no such thing as global warming. We got snow. And every one of those people I'd like to just smack upside the back of the head, because the climate change, we end up getting much more severe weather. And I don't know that anybody can look around and go, the weather's not getting more severe, because it is. And look, I'm not a climate expert. I'm not a climate scientist. It makes sense to me, though. And, you know, there are some common sense solutions of things we could be doing. And even if you don't believe that it's man-made, wouldn't you want to err on the side of caution? Just kind of a thought? Probably not. But as they point out, 7 of the top 10 countries with the highest displacement by proportion, the refugees, are small developing states, mostly island states, largely in the Pacific and Caribbean. That's what they're finding. And at some point, I think eventually you're just going to have to abandon those. I don't know that you're going to build a levee system around an island that's going to keep them safe. So we'll see where this goes. But I have no faith in this administration. Because here you have this administration who's actively doing everything they can possibly do to keep us from doing, oh, I don't know, anything. And you've got the cheerleaders going, well, you know, he's just being tough. No, he's being stupid. And here we are, another 4 years behind. Another 4 years back where we should have been doing, and it's going to make the pain of actually dealing with this crisis much, much worse. I mean, we could have, if we put ourselves to it, we could build a green economy that built new industries and created millions of new jobs. We could invest in something towards the future that would get us off of dirty fossil fuels, would rebuild our infrastructure in a very sustainable way with high-speed rail. You know, I was just reading a story the other day. Evidently, the Chinese have built and have perfected and are using this magnetic levitation train. Maglev is what they call it. There was actually a company in Pittsburgh called Maglev. I met the CEO about 10 years ago. It was U.S. Steel, the steel workers, a number of progressive green organizations who were getting together, were trying to push this idea through that you could build one of these magnetic levitation trains that could go from Pittsburgh through Harrisburg to Philadelphia. You could use it for high-speed rail. And now the Chinese have perfected it and are actually building it. And the damn thing goes 373 miles an hour. they're saying it's faster than air travel. And the technology, as I remember the guy, because UTU, the United Transport Union, the guy who was the head here in Harrisburg, was explaining it to me. And that's how I got to meet the CEO, because they were really big into this. It's all magnets. And then, it glides on these rails. And, the ride is supposedly incredible. And you could have high speeds. And it was a low cost. You could build it. And it was easy to maintain. It was great. We just didn't have any investment for it. And you go to the Obama years, where we were actually talking about building trains. And we're actually talking about, hey, how do we move people around? How do we get public transit so people can get to work and to stores and into the places that they need to get to conveniently? And what did we get? We got Republican governors all over this country, stomping their feet, plugging their ears and screaming, no, we're not doing any of that. And what did we get? Virtually nothing. It's insane to me that really the only way I can get to California or Chicago or anywhere is jumping on a plane or driving in my car. I would love the idea of, jumping on a train and within, 6-7 hours getting to where I need to go. But we don't have that capacity. The best we've got is the Amtrak. And I think they do like 90 miles an hour, maybe up to 100. We've got no high-speed rail in this country. And that's by design. The wealthiest country in the history of civilization. We could easily have the best infrastructure in the world. We could easily build the most innovative public transit system in the world. We just don't want to. Now, I have a lot of people who have theories on that. One, the auto industry and the oil industry are so powerful. They're lobbying so powerful. And that's true. Another part of it is we don't want those people moving around. And that's true. I live in an area where when I first moved to where I live now, there was the talk of putting in a light rail or having a dedicated bus line or something on one of the old rail paths. And the opposition was, well, we don't want those people from Harrisburg coming out this way. And so they didn't get themselves a way to get into Harrisburg because they were afraid those people were going to come from Harrisburg. So there was no corridor one. And the idea was to link up all of the little cities around central Pennsylvania so that you could go on light rail and get to different places. But that didn't happen because, well, we didn't want to spend the money and we didn't want those people. Kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? Kind of makes you wonder if we'll ever have anything nice. Like your mother always said, we can't have anything nice. You always wonder if that's ever going to happen, if we're always going to deny ourselves things that we need because someone else might get it. Seems childish, seems ridiculous, but it seems like we do it all the time. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1916. That was the day that 7 Australian members of the Industrial Workers of the World were sentenced to 15 years in prison for their anti-war efforts during World War I. Other IWW members were sentenced to as many as 5 and 10 years each. The IWW had led the way in protesting the use of the draft, or what was called conscription, during World War I. On August 10th, 1914, the front page of the Australian IWW newspaper, Direct Action, had declared war. For what? For the workers and their dependents? Death, starvation, poverty, and untold misery. For the capitalist class? Gold, stained with the blood of millions. Riotous luxury, banquets of jubilation over the graves of their dupes and slaves.
An Australian Wobbly leader, Tom Barker, had urged, "Let those who own Australia do the fighting. Put the wealthiest in the front ranks. The middle class next. Follow these with politicians, lawyers, sky pilots, and judges. Answer the declaration of war with a call for a general strike." Barker was arrested and jailed more than once for his stance on the war. In 1916, Australians had grown increasingly weary of the fighting. They voted no in a referendum on the continued use of conscription. That September 1916, the government raided IWW offices and arrested key leaders. The leaders were sentenced to long prison terms. 9 months later, the IWW was outlawed in Australia. The membership rolls were made available to employers who blacklisted anyone on the lists. Continued involvement in the IWW could result in 6 months hard labor in the work camps. This government oppression took a sharp toll on the union. But to its credit, the IWW still exists in Australia to this day.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here's another one of those evangelical stories. Evidently, this really popular televangelist in Alabama. And why is it, you know, why does this happen so often? Anyway, this televangelist, Acton Bowen, he has pled guilty to 28 charges of raping and sexual assaulting multiple children between the ages of 12 and 16. Good God-fearing Christian there he was. He was arrested in 2018, but before that, he was the host of XL Rhodes TV, a global broadcast that, you know, basically reached millions of people who were dumb enough to give him money. And this is, you know, this is one of those things where you just go, you know, how many of these televangelists do we have to put up with? To me, they're all charlatans. To me, they're all crooks. They're all just looking for a handout. I mean, if you really wanted to preach and do that, you know, go do good work. You don't need $60 million jets. You don't need massive estates. And you're certainly not out molesting children. Just kind of a thought. But look, you know, not surprising. Not surprising to me as well at all. Anyway, the other side of this, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, evidently, Mike is building a war chest. I guess he's planning to run for Senate. And he's got folks like evidently Sheldon Adelson and some other folks, some other mega donors who are looking to fund his Senate bid. And I'm looking at this is the last guy that I think should be anywhere near the U.S. Senate. Simply because look at what he's done as Secretary of State. I mean, this guy scares me. And the reason I put these stories together is Pompeo's one of these religious guys. He's one of these left behind people. He's one of these rapture people. And at some point, there's part of me that goes, we got to get rid of these people. We've got to move them along out of office. Look, you want to have kooky views. You want to, you know, you want to think that the spaceship is coming to take you and 1,000 other people away while the rest of us are slaughtered. You go believe that. You want to go read the books. Good luck for you. But you should be nowhere near the halls of power and of policymaking whatsoever. Because you then end up in a situation where we are with this guy now, where nothing is ever wrong. You know, and my thinking on these religious zealots really changed when I interviewed Jeff Charlotte. He wrote the book and that turned into the Netflix series, The Family. And one of the things that stuck with me from my interview with Jeff was he said, look, you know, these folks, people like Pompeo, people like Mark Sanford, you know, all of these C Street people, nothing applies to them. No bad deed ever is bad enough for them. In fact, the worse you are, the more you're doing God's work. And it was a weird kind of way of looking at it, but it makes a lot of sense in that, you know, these are chosen people. They truly believe that they are chosen, and which is why it's so scary to me. People keep going, well, you know, Trump does all this stuff. You know, he grabs women by the you-know-what. He's, you know, he's a liar, a cheater, and a, you know, he's a crook. He's all of these things, and he is. It's well documented. And people then go, well, why do these Christian people, you know, why do they support him? Because they believe he's chosen. Their minds are broken. They believe he's the chosen one. God brought him before us. God's will. And for all his flaws and all of his bad things, he's bringing us the good stuff. And we're going to finally be able to go after those single mothers who get pregnant and make them have those kids. We're going to finally kick those people off of welfare so they have to go and work. And we can finally go get those gay people. And look, you know, they're going to want to do what they do in Uganda, which is take them out and kill them. They don't tell you that yet. But that's really the goal. I want to go back to the good fire and brimstone. And that's who these evangelical folks are. And that's the scary part in all of this. They put on a smiley face and they wear a nice suit and they, you know, they've got good PR and good marketing. But ultimately, they're scary people. These are people who would literally take food from the mouths of children. You know, there's a photo that someone sent me of a German guard holding, like dangling a piece of bread over a starving child. I mean, the kid was nothing but bones. Barely had any skin over. And it's a famous photo. The guy's holding a piece of bread and the kid's, you know, trying to reach for it. He can't even get his arms up. This is who these people are. And their thought process would be, well, that guy was chosen. He was chosen to hold that piece of bread over that kid. So, you know, who am I to say? The level of justification just scares the living daylights out of me. And even the people who follow this child rapist who's pled guilty to these 28 charges and who I hope never sees the light of day. Even them, I think they could justify, well, you know, he was chosen. Scary, scary stuff. And unfortunately, we've got too many of these people in our government. Because the one thing the radical right, the religious right, has really done well is they understood politics. And this goes back into the 70s and 80s. This is not new. The idea of building Christian warriors is not new. The idea of a political revolution based on their extreme Christian beliefs, not new. You know, 1980, you had Paul Weyrich, one of the co-founders of the Heritage Foundation, you know, talking to Baptist ministers in Dallas, Texas, asking them how many of them want everyone to vote. And he said, I don't want everyone to vote. Our leverage goes down as the voting populace goes up. So if they can suppress the vote, if they can keep people at home, they can demoralize or put obstacles in the road. They keep people from the polls while increasing the number of their people coming out to the polls. It's simple. Maniacal, but simple. And then you got these quiverful groups who have, you know, 15, 16, 20 kids. All for why? To build that Christian army of Republican voters who understand that the Supreme Court is the power in this country. You understand that the only way you're going to, you know, really gain control is if you take the ability for women to control their own bodies away. If you control people by how they act and think and feel, keep them in the closets or in the fields or in the kitchens. They get it. It's scary stuff. And I hate pointing it out in those kind of stark terms, but that's where we are. That's who now the Republican Party is owned by. And it's frightening. There's no more moderate Republicans. I've known some over the years. They've all been ostracized. They've all been expelled. So who are going to be the champions who lead the Republican Party to sanity? I don't know. I know it's not Lindsey Graham, I'll tell you that, or Devin Nunes. I'd love to hear your thoughts, though. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Breaking news, Donald Trump has...